This is fun! The FU Network!
This is an FU Network special presentation of the This is Van Color podcast, hosted by Mo Amir.
This is Van Color. We're at the West Coast!
My name is Mo Amir, and today on This is Van Color, I am joined by Canada's premier animal rights lawyer. For over a decade, she has been a trailblazer in developing animal law in Canada, founding the first animal law section of the Canadian Bar Association, and she's the founder and current chair of the Animal Law Section BC branch. She also sits on the board of directors of the Vancouver Humane Society. She founded the Animal Law course at the University of British Columbia, where she has also been an adjunct professor. She has graced many local media outlets, but finally, she is here on This is Van Color. She is one of the top 25 most influential lawyers in Canada, as per Canadian Lawyer magazine, the founder of Bretter Law. She is Rebecca Bretter. Rebecca, how are you?
Thank you so much. It's so sweet. I'm so well. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
My pleasure. I'm very excited to have you here. I hear you on CKNW all the time. I've even seen you on television. So I think it's cool that you're willing to come here and dumb down some of these important issues for a basic bro like me.
Oh, please. Oh, but I can't emphasize enough. And I'm honored. Thank you so much.
I have a very obvious question.
Shoot.
Who exactly are you representing in your work? Because from my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, animals can't hire legal representation. So who is paying the bills here?
Very good question. Well, it's funny. Obviously, I'm representing the people who mm-hmm. are trying to defend the interests of animals. And obviously, they're the ones paying me. But what I do tell all of my clients is, well, you know you're my client, technically. But really, my true client is the animal or the animals that are really at the heart of the issue that we're fighting about.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So my clients tend to be, it depends what issue I'm dealing with. Mm-hmm. I describe my practice as partly representing private individuals and partly representing issues dealing with public law issues, and in those cases, those would be issues for animal protection organizations. So
okay.
for like private individuals, they would be cases like I defend dogs, I help people who want to bring a claim against a veterinarian, mm-hmm. or if there are people living in a condominium or strata, as we call them here in BC, and the strata wants to kick their animal out. I do not represent the strata. I only represent the people with the animals. And on that note, I only take on cases where I feel I could either help the animal directly mm-hmm. or I could help advance the state of animal law generally in BC and in Canada.
Okay.
So for anyone listening there, and if they were bit by a dog and they're like, oh, I need an animal law lawyer who can help me because it involves a dog. And I want that dog put down. No, that is not me. You've got the wrong girl for that.
Sure.
No, definitely not.
So private individuals, and you said organizations as
well. That's right. Animal protection organizations.
Okay.
Like as an example, so I either take on cases where we sue governments or I do some consulting for them behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And a current example is I act for the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition, the CHDC. And it's a wonderful animal protection organization that's dedicated for the protection of horses in Canada, and mainly to end the slaughter of horses in Canada and the mm-hmm. export of horses out of Canada. And we're suing the federal government over the way they're transporting horses to be slaughtered in Japan.
Oh, okay.
To be turned into sushi meat. Yeah. So just a few examples.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you're not a prosecutor, so you're not involved with cruelty cases or anything like that, to be clear.
That's right. So the one area I don't actively litigate or just litigate in general are animal cruelty cases, because the only lawyers who can take those cases on are government lawyers who act as prosecutors on behalf of the government to prosecute cases of animal cruelty.
Okay.
That may change one day. I don't know. But right now, it's not part of my private practice. And also, just to be clear, I'm a lawyer in private practice, an animal law lawyer in private practice. There are other animal law lawyers in Canada who are professors.
Okay.
So they have a law degree and they teach animal law.
Mm-hmm.
There are animal lawyers who are in the nonprofit sector,
mm-hmm.
who are advocates essentially, who use their legal training and skills to lobby the government and to educate people about animal law and animal rights issues.
Sure. You're very pro-animal, it sounds like, as you said. you pick the cases that you take. Are you a vegan too?
I am.
So you walk the walk.
I am.
You're so and Vancouver.
No, I don't know if it's just so Vancouver. I'm so me. I mean, it's not a secret. I'm 42 and I've been vegetarian since I've been in my mid-teens.
Oh, wow.
and vegan over the last few years. So vegan for a smaller number of years compared to the number of years I've been vegetarian.
Sure.
But it's really all because I know too much. I know too much, and because of the nature of the work that I do, I know how horribly animals are treated in the farming agricultural sector, and a whole bunch of other things. I know I don't want to get off topic, but
well, let's get into this field, because you clearly are a trailblazer in your field, a field which I assume is relatively new in the legal consciousness. How common is it for animal welfare and animal rights to be codified into law around the world?
It's becoming definitely more of a common issue that we're hearing about. I would say if you rewind the clock even 10 years ago, animal issues and animal rights, or animal protection, as I prefer to call it, would not have been in the news so much, would not have been legislated as much as it is now. And I shouldn't say as much. I'm making it sound, I don't want to make it sound like, oh, it's being like animal issues are being legislated, changing laws are being changed all the time now.
Sure.
It's not. But we are seeing a growing trend where politicians and those in charge of making changes in the law are taking animal issues seriously. And I think we'll get to some of those changes that are that have happened just recently in Canada in a moment from now. But so is it common? I'd like to say yes, but I don't think it's full on common right now. I think it's a growing, put it this way, it's a growing interest around the world, and it particularly here in Canada.
And as a growing interest, it would seem to me, and maybe this is being too broad, but it would seem to me like there's a lot of stuff we have to figure out in the legal realm if it's new,
oh,
right?
Oh, so much stuff. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that one. I mean, that's a conversation that could just, that alone could take
the territory
well over
still
now.
Has to be charted, I guess, is my
It does,
my
because
point.
I think the fundamental issue is that animals are still considered property. And so we being human beings can essentially do whatever we like with them. They're ours to do what we like.
Right.
There are, now that said, of course there are laws governing the limits of what we can do to a certain extent. Like we do have in Canada animal cruelty laws where it is against the law to be cruel to an animal. But then there's a whole host of other issues that arise from that, because our laws are not the greatest. I mean, they're not I wouldn't say that they're the worst. Some animal rights activists do say that we have some of the worst animal laws in Canada.
Like BC does?
Canada in general.
Has the worst laws in the world.
For dealing with animal cruelty laws.
Oh, interesting.
They're definitely not that great. I mean, the recent changes that have been made that, again, we'll talk about in a moment. But generally speaking, they're definitely not good, but they're not as bad because the potential is there to litigate them. And fundamentally, it comes down to finding the right prosecutor with the right expert who can prove that there was animal cruelty in the case. Now, I'm really like keeping it general here.
Sure, sure.
But it's all to say that, yeah, our laws are kind of sucky when it comes to protecting animals. But that said, there are definitely ways that we could still help animals with the use of our legal system.
Well, let's talk about one of the big animal rights stories this year, and that was the cetacean ban, the ban of whales and dolphins in captivity in Canada. And before we get into the legal realm, I just want to say this. I've always had a kinship with dolphins and orcas. I loved them growing up. They were magical and mesmerizing, and the aquarium was my favorite place. And I remember going to SeaWorld as a child and just being in awe of how magical and incredible these creatures were. And I totally did the hokey swim with the dolphins in Cuba, which I feel so bad about now. And
I'm glad to hear.
Well, I just feel bad about enjoying these dolphins and orcas in captivity the more I learned about them. I mean, I learned that they need to swim a lot every day. I learned about how they're pod-orientated and so family-orientated, and their emotional capacity in both breadth and depth is something that we can't even comprehend just based on the physiology of their brain. So it's hard because I'm guilty because I have all these good memories, but then also I've had some, I would call, responsible memories where I've swam with dolphins in the wild, or I've gone whale watching and I've seen pods of orcas.
Yeah.
And those, I think, because you're in the wild, become a lot more magical than being in a zoo or an aquarium. Do you feel that this ban on whales and dolphins in captivity takes on a more emotional toll, or there's just a more emotional resonance because a lot of us have maybe childhood memories attached with it, or because as science has come more into the mainstream, we understand more about these creatures?
Yeah, I mean, you were very honest with your past experience, and let me be honest with mine, and which I think many people will probably not know, is that, well, for this part, they would know, I think, that I'm originally from Montreal. I moved here 19 years ago to go to law school to help animals with the law, but growing up in Montreal, I started being an animal rights activist in my teens.
Okay.
And before then, I've always loved animals. We had animals at home. We would go to my, and I remember specifically going with my father to, I forget what it's called now, it was by the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, to see dolphins perform.
Yeah.
And we went more than once. We went, I think, a bunch of times. And I remember, and I must have been like, probably like my daughter's age, I don't know, anywhere between 5 and 8, I guess. And I just remember watching them and like throwing the balls in the pool.
Yeah.
And there were people interacting with them. And there was like a whole lively experience there. And my memory of that was, oh, yeah, that's cool. But then fast forward just several years later, and kind of like what you're saying about how you learned about their social structure, their intelligence, the fact that these are sentient beings.
Yeah.
It doesn't take that long.
And they have language and...
Yes, they have language, and they're some of the smartest creatures on the planet. And I felt terrible. And to this day, I feel terrible. But you can't undo what what is done. You can only learn from it.
Totally.
And I think that there's no point in feeling guilty about it, even though I just said I feel terrible about it. But I don't dwell on it.
Yeah.
I don't dwell on it because I think a lot of us have learned from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But the critical thing here is that while my memory of it was, oh, that's cool to see dolphins jump and throw the ball, I did not learn anything from that. I didn't learn anything about dolphins.
Yeah.
I didn't learn about their social structure, about how intelligent they are, how they communicate and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is why I find it infuriating when I see institutions that still keep cetaceans in captivity and they claim that it's a benefit to educate children, that it's a benefit because we're teaching children to have a connection with wildlife and to learn about these majestic animals.
Right.
I say that is total BS. What kids do get out of it is kind of what I got out of it at that time, which is, oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Do they learn anything of substance about the animals? No.
Yeah.
And if anything, I would say that it's a detriment, could be a detriment in the long run to the kids and to the relationships that they could foster with animals and the views that they have of animals by taking them to aquaria and to shows like that. Like,
right.
I think I became who I am partly because I know my parents and my mother specifically cares very much about animals. And so maybe I was influenced by that. And I realized that, okay, going to aquaria is wrong. I've also read about it and studied it in school. And, you know, just my interest, I gravitated towards that and I learned about it. But unless kids get that type of exposure, right, either through their parents or on their own, I think what we're actually teaching children by going to aquaria is that, oh, it's okay to keep animals in tiny tanks that are completely unnatural and where they're suffering both physically and, more importantly, mentally, because
yeah.
they're bored out of their minds and depressed out of their minds. I think we're sending a message to kids and teaching them that it's okay. It doesn't matter. We could just do that to animals. They're there for our use and our entertainment. So if that's the education you want to teach children, and if that's what you call education, then fine. Well, not fine. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
there's no...
Well, we can't have a conversation at that point.
No.
You're right.
And there's no... There is... I could... Like, I wholeheartedly believe that there is absolutely no educational value to keeping animals, whether it's cetaceans, which for those who may not know, cetaceans are whales, dolphins, and porpoises.
Mm-hmm.
There's no education value in keeping these animals in captivity at all. And now I could just hear, you know, the voices saying, well, yes, because how often, you know, we're not rich. We can't go to Africa to bring our kids to a safari. Maybe we can't afford to go on a whale watching tour, you know, and we want our kids to be exposed to animals. And, you know, I could see on the face of it that there is some... I definitely don't want to say merit. I could see the appeal to parents wanting to bring their kids to zoos and aquaria because they feel like they don't have any other opportunity where their kids can be close to the animals.
Sure.
But that is not the way to do it. You know what? Especially nowadays.
Yeah.
Fine, even if you can't go to a safari in Africa, like most of us can't, I can't now, which is on my bucket list. I hope to do that one day. Even if you can't go on a whale watching tour right off the coast of BC, there's TV, there's videos, there's like the technology nowadays is there. There are books. And yes, granted, it's not the same as being able to see a whale like right there in front of you in the tank. But is that worth keeping an animal in a concrete tank that is a fraction, like the slightest fraction of what they would normally swim in the wild or roam in the wild? No, it's not worth it. So even if, you know, a parents tell me, well, you know, We don't mean to be cruel to the animals. We don't think it's being cruel. It is. Like, you're not the one directly whipping the animal and you're not causing physical harm yourself. Mm-hmm. But by giving money to these institutions, we are we're ensuring that they continue to exist and to continue to make animals suffer. And I really do believe, and I openly say, that it is animal cruelty mm-hmm. to keep animals in captivity.
And like I said, this is one of those issues that I feel generates a lot of emotion from all sides, because yes. there is a defensiveness from parents or maybe people like us who saw whales and dolphins in captivity as children, and we have good memories, and maybe some of us feel guilty and some of us don't. It just seems like it's overwrought with a lot of emotions.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah, no, I agree. As are most animal protection or animal rights issues. You
yeah.
have those who feel very strongly for and very strongly against whatever the issue is.
So let's talk about the ban specifically. What does it mean? Because as far as I know, there's only two facilities now in Canada that house cetaceans.
Yes.
The Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland in Ontario.
Yes, that's right.
So what does the ban mean? Why is it significant?
Okay. So what it means is that it bans the keeping of cetaceans in captivity. And again, we're talking about whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Mm-hmm. The law also bans the breeding of cetaceans.
Okay.
And it bans the import and export of cetaceans. What it means for the current animals in captivity, for the current cetaceans, and let me just say, you're right. In Canada, there's only the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland that mm-hmm. still have cetaceans. Marineland has many, many more. Marineland has about 55 beluga whales.
What? Actually?
They have 55 beluga whales, 5 dolphins, and 1 orca. And Vancouver Aquarium has 1 beluga.
They have 55 belugas?
Yeah.
In what?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been there.
Yeah.
I haven't been there.
Oh my God. That's a lot.
And just to be clear, they may not all be there.
Okay.
They rent them out and they own them. But I think they actually own more than that. But in any event, those are the only two institutions. So for the animals that are still, that are there at this moment, at the time the law was passed, which was just this past June. Mm-hmm. In 2019, after years of being debated, they are grandfathered in, which means that they get to stay.
Sure.
But for future animals, they're not allowed keeping them in captivity anymore. Now, there is an exception. There is an exception in the law where there's an exception for rescue, research, and rehabilitation.
Okay.
You know, so it's not a perfect law because I think it leaves some room to, well, what does rescue mean? What does rehabilitation mean? What does, that said, that if these facilities want to keep these animals for those purposes, again, for rescue, research, and rehabilitation, they have to get a license from the government. So we'll see, you know, how that works, how often will these licenses be given, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about this law is that even if there is what I think is this loophole in it, they're not allowed to show these animals for entertainment purposes.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So,
that was my next question.
Yeah. So they're not allowed to show them for entertainment purposes. And I think that I don't want to say closes the loophole entirely, but it definitely shuts
the
door.
Takes away incentive.
It does. It does. So they won't.
So the current animals can be shown for entertainment purposes.
No, they can't. No.
The current animals cannot.
No, they cannot be shown for entertainment purposes. They get to stay there, but not for entertainment purposes. So we'll see how that works out too, because for a facility like the Vancouver Aquarium, where the beluga is, and I've seen footage of the beluga, how it's basically one, it's literally like one small little tiny pool.
Yeah.
Which is just, okay, I'm not going to start over that again, but it's so heartbreaking to see this beautiful, sentient, social animal be completely alone and just going around in tiny circles all friggin' day. Like, it is. Anyway, so the point is, I'm not too sure how they're going to deal with
that. Yeah, so when does this kick in? Because as far as I know, you can still see that beluga at Vancouver Aquarium. I haven't heard of Marineland effectively shutting down. I mean, that's what they would have to do if you can't.
I don't know. We'll see how that works out. Yeah, we'll see how that works out.
So the ban means that they can keep them, but they cannot show them for entertainment purposes.
That's right. That's right.
What if, I mean, if you have 55 belugas, maybe not all at once, but what if they breed?
Okay, that's a good question. And that was one of the issues that the lawyer for Marineland raised during the hearings in front of the Senate and the Justice Committee in Parliament, is that it's the law as drafted is unconstitutional, because what happens to those whales that may be pregnant and then they deliver during, like right after the law is passed? We'll see. I think those whales had to be taken out, but we'll see. I don't have an update with what happened, if anything, with a beluga that was pregnant. But no, the point is they're not allowed. They are not allowed breeding them.
Okay.
Now, and if they are, they're in violation of the law. And what that means is that if they're in violation of the law, it's a criminal code offense, and they can't, for this particular law, they can't not go to jail, but they could be fined up to $200,000.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and also, just so that the listeners understand, this law, this cetacean ban, the ban on keeping whales, dolphins, and porpoises in captivity, it's an amendment to the criminal code. So it's not like you could look up an actual piece of legislation or law that specifically deals with this. It's part of the criminal code, and then you have to scroll through the criminal code, and then it'll be in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but overall, I have to say that it is an absolutely incredible thing that Canada has banned the keeping of cetaceans at the federal level, because that means that no province, no city, no county, no, like, no one in Canada can bring in these animals and keep them in captivity anymore.
And so, to be clear, because this is actually blowing my mind, right now, no whale, dolphin, porpoise that is in captivity in Canada between these two facilities can be shown for entertainment purposes.
That's now, yes, that's what it is. But now, is there a way to argue around that? Well, you know what? Actually, I'm not going to give them ideas about how to argue around
but
that.
The idea, they're maybe they're just swimming, but they're not doing anything for.
If that's what they want to say, that's kind of ridiculous, I think. But they're not allowed. They're not allowed keeping them for entertainment purposes. No, they're grandfathered in. And so they're not allowed, like, showing the beluga do tricks and jump and things like that. Yeah. So,
but the beluga would still be there for viewing, presumably.
I think, especially for the Vancouver Aquarium, I think that's a very good possibility.
Yeah.
And if they're talking to kids about the beluga and trying to teach them, maybe. But again, like, how much kids actually learn about the beluga and belugas in general, I think is minimal, if anything at all.
So if there is a dolphin or whale that is rescued in the wild and, let's say, objectively could not survive in the wild, will it be then rescued by some of these facilities and housed? How does that work in the future?
Well, we're going to see what we're really hoping for in the future, and it's already in the works. There's the Whale Sanctuary Project, and there are a couple of other, and one other key organization that are working on creating sanctuaries, seaside sanctuaries for injured cetaceans, and hopefully to get the cetaceans that are currently at the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland and maybe elsewhere in the world to put them in these sanctuaries. They're looking at waters off the coast of Eastern Canada and Western Canada, although I think that Eastern Canada may be the place for it.
Okay.
And so these are sanctuaries. Some may say, well, what's the difference? Like, they're still in captivity. Right? But huge difference.
Yeah.
For one,
they're an open ocean.
Open ocean. It's not a friggin' tank.
Yeah.
Concrete tank.
Yeah.
It's in the natural environment, and yet and significantly bigger. Well, not only will they be able to swim a good distance, but they'll be able to dive with down below, which is what they're meant to do and what they do naturally.
Right.
and it will be what it's proposed is that people will be able to view them from a distance, mm-hmm. not feed them fish and crackers and whatever sure. else. But they'll be able to watch, it's like whale watching from the coastline.
Yeah.
And that is a true educational experience. Mm-hmm. And they'll provide reading material. And it'll be kind of, I don't know if you've taken road trips across Canada or sometimes, or camping or whatever. I love camping. And so when we go hiking or whatever, and we take trails, and they're like these, you walk along the forest or wherever you are, and there are these posts, and it gives you some information sure. about what you're looking at. And yeah. so that's the idea
cool.
With these sanctuaries.
What are the research benefits, if any, that truly exist? Because you hear about the Vancouver Aquarium saying that they do all this research on the animals that they have, and this helps the animals, this helps science. Is there any benefit to the research? What kind of research are they doing?
Okay, obviously, I have a certain perspective on this.
Sure.
And obviously, if you ask, let's say, a veterinarian or a scientist who's employed by one of these aquaria institutions, they'll have a different view. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not a scientist, but I know just from my work in the area and my experience in the animal protection movement, there is no research value.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me rephrase that. Maybe I'll give them this. Maybe there's very little research value. Maybe not like no research value at all, mm-hmm. but little research value. But what they generally speaking, no question that what they learn about is how these animals are in captivity.
Right.
Not about how these animals are in the wild,
yeah.
but how these animals are in captivity. And how does that research help the animals in the wild? It doesn't.
Right.
And
that's
so,
a good point.
So that's why I can't say no research value, because there's, you know, I guess arguably there's some research value because you learn about how they are in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no research value in the sense of how that research applies to the animals in the wild. Maybe there's some basic things, but these are probably basic things that they'd be able to learn about just watching them and observing them in the wild.
Sure.
Or yeah. even if there was, I would say that even if there was arguably something new that they have learned about the dolphins in or belugas in captivity, which mm-hmm. I think the Vancouver Aquarium specifically claims that they have, right? Is it worth keeping these sentient beings in captivity where they suffer mentally and physically on a daily basis to learn that one little thing? No, it's mm-hmm. not. And I would forego that whatever little thing that they claim they've learned to have them out in the wild where
sure.
eventually we would learn.
From your perspective, and obviously you take on an activist's perspective, an activist's lens as well, are there any animals that should be kept in captivity? Where do you draw the line?
Okay, I guess it depends how you define captivity.
Okay.
Right, because animals...
Like a fish tank with fish is captive, right?
Yes, that I would say no. But arguably, animals that...
No, instant, like, that's fine?
Yeah, fish and tanks, no. And I have to say, okay, that said...
But you can keep fish and tanks?
No.
Oh,
no,
you
no,
can't?
No.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't. No, and I... Okay, so if you ask me this, and I say this openly again.
Yeah.
I remember as a child, we had fish in, like, little goldfish mm-hmm. in fish tanks.
Yeah.
Not for very long. I think we did that for a few years.
Yeah.
And I think now looking back, that is wrong. We're learning more and more about fish, too.
Mm.
And we're learning about how even these little guys are sentient, they feel, and they're smart. And they've done research studies on fish showing how they have good memories, how they form bonds,
right.
they recognize faces. Mm. And I know it's hard because it's, you know, you think of this little fish like, oh, what's the harm? Because a tank is like 10 times the size of this little
yeah.
fish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I get it. And then, I mean, you see them even in malls. You see them in like at the dentist or wherever, or at people's houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I feel, and especially now knowing what we're starting to learn more about fish, I think it is wrong. But to answer your question, is there ever, like, is it ever right to keep an animal in captivity? So just to be clear, because sanctuaries, by definition, it is captivity, right?
Yeah.
So if it's a true, and we have to be careful about that too, because now, you know, it's the in thing to say, oh, we're a sanctuary. We're right. a sanctuary for the wildlife.
Right.
We have to be really careful about whether it's genuine, like whether it's a genuine sanctuary or if it's someone who's disguising themselves as a sanctuary.
Yeah. How about dogs and cats?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's I know.
Where do you stand morally? I'm just curious.
I know. I don't want to go into like this whole rabbit hole, as they say in English. Dogs and cats have been domesticated for God knows how many centuries. I think it is very unrealistic
to release say, them in the wild.
Yeah. To release them in the wild and to say no dogs and cats allowed.
Yeah. Those poor chihuahuas.
Right. And I certainly, I mean, I've had dogs and cats my entire life. What I do, I strongly urge people is to adopt as opposed to go to a breeder, especially because they're not that all breeders are bad.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of them who are, but there's such an overpopulation of unwanted and abandoned cats and dogs and guinea pigs and, you know, you name it, that I always suggest to people that if they want an animal, rescue one first before anything. And, mm-hmm. and actually on that note, what I also say is if you want a dog or a cat, do you want a kid? Because I think people should take it as seriously as having a human child, because it's not just giving the animal, like the dog or cat, a bowl of food and that's it. Like,
let's talk about dogs for a second.
Yes.
One issue that you've brought up in the media is this idea of the dangerous canine and dogs that are labeled as such.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a case with a dog named Punky.
Mm.
Can you walk me through the issue in terms of what the dangerous canine label means, why it's important?
Yeah. How many minutes do we have?
I mean, we got like 20.
Like,
we got 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Give me a little brief on this, and then we'll get into it.
Okay, so let me... Yeah, this is a case. I mean, I feel terrible for the dog Punky and for the dog owner in this case, but let me just summarize it to say that the dog owner went to trial. Oh, sorry. Let me just back up even more. So the dog bit, Punky bit... he got into trouble after he had seriously bit a woman at Locarno Park in, like, by Jericho Beach in Vancouver. And Vancouver Animal Control seized him and wanted to have him killed, or they called destroyed. But prior to that, the dog has been involved in other biting incidents where he has caused injury to other people, including to the dog owner herself, according to the judge who heard the case the first time. So anyway, the city wanted to apply for what's called a destruction order, basically to have the dog killed. The dog owner wanted to fight it. She went to court, lost. She went to, then she appealed it to the Supreme Court, which is our mid-level court here in BC, lost, and then went to the Court of Appeal, which is our highest court here in BC. And it was at that point where I found out about the case, because essentially the city prosecution office called me and they're like, Rebecca, we think you'd be interested in this case because we're going to bring up the issue of jurisdiction. And really what that means is that prior to this case, dogs that have been labeled as, quote, dangerous. And let me just be clear. We are not talking about dogs that are, like, out there to kill and to, like, kill everything that moves and every child and every... No, we're talking about dogs who have maybe gotten into some trouble, have bit a person or bitten and maybe even killed another dog. And those are cases that I do defend. But in none of those cases, and I could easily, like... I could just bet on anything. None of these cases were these dogs inherently like crazy and vicious. It's just dogs are being dogs. So in BC and in many other parts in Canada, it's very easy for dogs to be labeled as dangerous. All it takes is one little bite or even a scratch or even in some cases like just a growl or lunging.
Really?
But yeah, it's crazy. But so under our provincial legislation, if a dog goes to trial and he is labeled as, quote, dangerous, in the past, courts have still released dogs on conditions. They were called conditional orders. Mm-hmm. And I could say I have never, ever lost a case defending a dog in these types of cases. Mm-hmm. And not because I'm like, I made some brilliant legal argument, although I'd like to think that some of that played a part in it.
Sure.
But it's because I was able to convince courts that just because a dog is, quote, dangerous doesn't mean he has to be killed. You could release a dog on conditions. And mm-hmm. the judges have agreed with me. And one of my cases in 2013 at the Supreme Court set a precedent for that. And so, yeah, and the law was, you know, case law was clear that dogs can be released on conditions. But now with this case at the Court of Appeal, it was like I really tried to convey the message to the legal team on both sides to please, like, find another solution and don't take this to the highest court, because the risk is what the city was telling me is that if they're going to raise the argument that the courts don't have the power to release dogs on conditions, that is it. That means an automatic death sentence for the dog. So while my heart has gone out and does go out to Punky in this case, this case has now, like, the whole case was about what the judges have said, and this is exactly what I warned about, is that there's no power to grant these conditional orders.
So is that where the case stands right now? Where
so now
that conditional
releases are not allowed.
They're not allowed.
They're not allowed now.
Wow.
And so that is, you know, I was unable to eat after like a whole week after this decision came out.
So now in Canada or in BC?
This is BC.
Okay, so now in BC.
This is just in BC.
If a dog is deemed dangerous, it is automatically
in court. So let's just be clear, because animal control still very often around the province still goes around and hands out letters to dog owners saying your dog's aggressive or dangerous.
Sure.
No, so it's not, I'm not talking about those cases or those incidents. I'm talking about when the city actually takes a matter to court and wants a destruction application. They want the dog killed. So that's the risk with dog owners now, is that if the dog is deemed dangerous by the court now does not have the power to release the dogs on conditions. And what really breaks my heart is that a lot of media out there have been portraying this as, you know, a win in animal law, which is like the total opposite. This is a devastating loss for all future dogs in BC. So, but where this case stands now is, from what I understand, is that the dog owner wants to appeal this now to the Supreme Court of Canada, which is the highest court in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, while I had huge reservations about this case going to the highest court of BC because of what ended up happening, I hope that they do get, they have to get permission. It's called leave. They have to get permission to be heard by the Supreme Court of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that they do get it so that this terrible precedent can hopefully be reversed.
Right.
And so that things can go back to the way they were. Like, we had 15 years of, while again, the law was certainly not perfect because the law itself like didn't help us much, but the case law, and that's when you go to court and judges make decisions and other judges rely on those decisions. We had 15 years of good case law that said dogs could be released on conditions, but now we don't anymore. And so there is, okay, that said, I just want to say there is a glimmer of hope. And while I say I have never lost a case, I'm going to see, you know, my track record now going forward, because it'll be that much harder to win.
Sure.
But I do see a glimmer of hope, because fundamentally, and this is what dog owners need to know, fundamentally what the court will want to know in these cases is if the dog poses an unacceptable risk to the public going forward.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can show to the court that You've bought a muzzle now, that you've hired an animal behaviorist, a dog trainer, and you're doing all these things to prevent something like this from happening again. Hopefully that will help save the dog, but we're yet to see.
As per your knowledge, have there been any dogs destroyed
after conditional releases? No. And that's a thing. Okay. Like in my cases.
But as a result of this case with Punky, have there been dogs destroyed that maybe would have been given a conditional release?
I currently have three or four, about to get a fourth case. And one of them may have to be. And it really comes down to the dog owner's financial ability to continue paying not only legal fees, but the city and I are now trying to find a creative way to get around this terrible precedent to see if there's a way that we could still release a dog on conditions, but it's not really a conditional order. Anyway, it gets a bit technical, so I'm not going to get into that.
Sure.
Suffice it to say that...
But there are dogs that are in trouble now because they cannot get that conditional release.
Oh, yes. Definitely. And it really, like... And I think this is also a personal issue for me.
Of course, yeah.
Because for years, unfortunately, Taro died January 24th of this year, but he was a Great Dane Mastiff, and he was a bit of an a-hole, I have to say, but we were able to manage him and really well, not rehabilitate him, because dogs, and that's a thing, people very often confuse being able to manage a dog versus rehabilitate a dog. It's like people with diabetes or people with bipolar disorder or people with, you know, mental health issues. You can't, in many cases, you cannot rehabilitate. You can manage with medication or with, you know, security measures of some kind. The same thing with dogs in many cases. Like you can't, in very, very often, dogs that have anxiety or stress, you know, and then that gets exhibited. It looks like aggression. It's not fundamentally aggression. It's actually anxiety. You can manage that.
Yeah.
And
Let me give you an example. We'll sort of end it on this note. Mm-hmm. My dad has a failed police dog, and she is the sweetest dog. And my dad, who is widowed, and Piper, they're just joined at the hip. Like, they have their own language. They totally get each other. They know, without even saying anything, they get each other. Piper has a quirk, though. She hates other dogs, foams at the mouth at the sight of other dogs. And my dad, you know, my dad got her when she was four, and he's put in a lot of time training her to not freak out. And she does very well. She tries really hard. But my dad's the only one that can walk her. He's the only one that can control her and knows the cues even before she freaks out. And she's also very protective. Like, she loves me, but if I even put a hand on my dad's shoulder, she'll jump on me. Not aggressively, because she knows who I am, but she'll get me to stop. Mm-hmm. Based on all of this and everything that's happened with Punky and now there being no conditional releases, what would your advice to my dad be in terms of making sure that the dog never gets into issues?
My very first piece of advice would be to call an animal behaviorist to assess the dog and to assess your dad.
Okay.
And so to see if there's anything that the animal behaviorist can recommend. And I'll give a shout out here to Dr. Rebecca Ledger. She's phenomenal. She is one of the very, very few qualified true animal behaviorists on the North Pacific coast.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of dog trainers. So I just want to caution the listeners that there are a lot of dog trainers out there who call themselves animal behaviorists. And there is no regulatory body or, you know, a government regulation or anything that regulates dog trainers or animal behaviorists.
Sure.
So anyone could really call themselves an animal behaviorist. So you have to be really careful with who you choose. But a good animal behaviorist will have qualifications from an education standpoint, like from a qualified university, and they'll have good experience in this. And it's basically like an animal psychiatrist. And it's so important because they'll be able to see, they could actually read the animal and to know, okay, is there something missing? Is maybe there's too high of a protein diet.
Right.
You know, that's something I've learned over the last decade. A high protein diet, maybe the leash is, you know, there could be a better leash for the dog or harness or whatever it is. But and then if ever in doubt, as self-serving as this may sound, but to call an animal lawyer to help, like to at least guide in the process, because there it's unbelievable how many calls I get with dog owners saying animal control was just here and they gave me a letter that designates my dog as vicious and she's so not. She's like the sweetest thing, but she did do this one little thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it has huge consequences because once you get a letter like that, people tend to think that they have to now abide by what animal control says, like always muzzle, always leash, and like you have to spend like a whole bunch of money on redoing your property so it's fully fenced. Anyway, point is that you got to talk to professionals who know what they're doing.
Okay.
And also I caution people that animal law is, I'm so happy to see it's a growing field. It is. There's still like, it's still in its infancy.
Yeah.
But for people to do their research well on who they retain, and there's a free legal database. It's called Canli, C-A-N-L-I-I. And they could do a quick search on the lawyer's last name to see, you know, what cases they've been involved in. Now, not all cases are reported, and actually most are not reported. What I mean by that is they're not in this legal database.
Sure.
But if a lawyer claims that they've been doing a certain area of law for a long time, whether it's animal law or whatever other area, there should be at least more than one case in there with
sure.
the lawyer's name.
Yeah, that makes
and
sense.
So I think ultimately people have to do their research with the professionals that they want to use to help them with their dog issues or any issues for that matter.
So if you have a quote unquote problematic dog, have a behavioralist look at it first.
Yes.
And sort of assess the needs.
Yes. I really would highly recommend that because they're psychiatrists essentially, or psychologists. I shouldn't say psychiatrists, because legally they don't have the right to prescribe medication in
sure.
BC because only a veterinarian can. But so I guess they're more akin to psychologists. But yes, they really should get a good qualified professional to help out. And that's what I would recommend to your dad. No matter, even if, and there are a lot of dog owners say, but I know my dog might be the best. And I like, I've been doing this for so long, which is precisely maybe the problem because you're so used to doing things a certain way that you may not realize that there may be another way.
Yeah.
Or something that you don't really recognize. You're still not the professional.
Sure.
Right?
So he's really good with her.
Oh,
he's
I'm
very
sure.
stubborn. But I will let him know that maybe he should look into it, maybe make a weekend out of it and
it's worth
never
it.
Looked out. Yeah.
Because there are even some minor, what are more minor recommendations that an animal behaviorist can make, like a switch in diet, let's say. Also to be checked out by a veterinarian, because sometimes even if we think our dogs are healthy, there could be an underlying issue.
Interesting.
That causes a certain behavior, including anxiety and stress. And it's always good to go to a veterinarian to work together with an animal behaviorist to figure out first, is there a physical reason, like a medical reason why the dog is the way he or she is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Our time's up.
Aw.
I know. There's so much more I want to learn. This was really fun, though, and this was outside of my wheelhouse, and I feel like I learned a lot. Like, it's absolutely fascinating, both on the whale's end and then on the dog's end.
Yes.
So I wanted to thank you for explaining some of these bigger issues to me in a very digestible way. If listeners want to do so, what's the best way for them to keep up with you and keep up with animal rights and animal law? this is your chance to plug your social media and everything else.
No, I think so. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me here.
Pleasure.
Like, I'm just, I had a great time too. If people want to reach me, they can go to BrederLaw.com. I'm also on Twitter at Animal Law Canada, all one word. And I make myself accessible to people, so please feel free to reach out to me. And to learn about animal rights and animal protection issues, like, just stay on top of the news. Don't believe everything you read in the news, though. But yeah, I'm more than happy to make myself available to people.
And I will say, your website has very interesting media clips of you talking about some of the hot topics or the big issues of the day.
Yes, I do have to. That reminds me, I do have to update my website. But yes, there's some information
there.
There's definitely information there that that people could start reading. And if there are any other questions, then please feel free to, my email is there, and my phone number is there. But BrederLaw.com is probably the easiest thing to remember, and at Animal Law Canada on Twitter.
Perfect. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, a trailblazer when it comes to animal rights, one of the most influential lawyers in our country, and the founder of Breder Law. She is Rebecca Breder, and I am Mo Amir, telling you that in a city where you can be anything, be colorful. Peace.
This is fun! The FU Network!
This is an FU Network special presentation of the This Is Van Color podcast, hosted by Mo Amir.